for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A recent article in London's Telegraph newspaper described Haile Selassie as not quite African and not quite American. Not Maya Angelou writing about American poverty or segregation, and not Chinua Achebe writing about colonialism in African villages. The characters in her new book are worldly and sophisticated, yet deeply defined by their immigrant experience and the political turmoil in their home country. Taye Selassie joins me to talk about her first novel, Ghana Must Go. And I hope you'll join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
I'm so glad.
Buongiorno.
Buongiorno. I'm so glad to see you. You know, this is a remarkable novel. I understand that you had wanted to write and wanted to write, and then you met Toni Morrison.
That's right.
And she gave you a deadline.
That's right.
Tell me about that.
I shall do. I met Professor Morrison at a dinner in Oxford, and we reconnected when I got back to the States. And after having seen her for a number of times without managing to produce anything at all for her to read, she said, "Send me something. Send me a manuscript by the end of next year."
Wow.
And I thought, I must, but how? I had nothing prepared, nothing written. The last time I'd written or rather finished any fiction was years and years prior. And so I just sat down with so much trepidation for about 6 months that I didn't write anything at all. And then finally, one day, I heard the opening line of what became the short story, The Sex Lives of African Girls. Sort of, I've said, playing in my head like a song remembered. And I just ran out, wrote it down, and the rest of the story came. That's what I sent to Professor.
You sent to her. And what was her reaction?
She liked it. Thank God.
That's so good. And then when did you begin Ghana Must Go?
Ghana Must Go came sometime later. So Sex Lives of African Girls was actually meant to be a novel, but all that I could manage in that first instance was a bit of a sort of half novella, if you will, which I knew even then wanted to be shorter and not longer.
What kind of reaction did you get from that book?
From that piece? Yeah, Sex Lives of African Girls was magically warmly received. But it's funny. Sex Lives has a funny story to it. I don't remember doing this, but I must have sent a manuscript for that short story to the U.S. office of Granta long before anything else happened, certainly before I'd even started Ghana Must Go. And over a year later, I write 100 pages of Ghana Must Go. I find my way to Andrew Wiley, who becomes my agent, and he sends Sex Lives of African Girls to the UK office of Granta. They like it very much. They buy it, and they decide to put it in the middle of their F-word issue, which was a blessing beyond blessing. But then, the timing was hilarious, Diane. A week after Granta UK buys Sex Lives of African Girls, I get an email from the U.S. office of Granta saying, "Dear Miss Selassie, thank you so much for sending us Sex Lives of African Girls for consideration, but we will not be printing it. We are not interested.
Oh,
the second
heaven.
Person just doesn't work, et cetera, et cetera." So I write to my agent and I say, "Wait, I don't understand. If they changed their mind, why didn't they just tell me?" But it turned out that one editor on one side of the pond loved it, and another one didn't want it. Same piece of writing, not a word changed. And so the reaction to Sex Lives, and then of course it went on to be printed more magically still in Best American Short Stories 2012. Same text. And I have to tell you, Diane, that was a lesson that I will never forget in my life as a writer.
What is the lesson?
It's all subjective. it is all subjective. One person can love the text and think that it is, you know,
magical.
A beacon. Exactly. And another person, it just doesn't work for them.
Right.
It just, and I met the editor who rejected it. He just didn't like it. He just didn't like it. And you know, that's allowed.
That's allowed. Tell me about the title, Ghana Must Go.
So all of my titles come to me the way the stories come, which is immediately. Sex Lives came that way. Ghana Must Go came that way. When I first started typing it in Microsoft Word, I saved that original document, the first save as, I saved it, Ghana Must Go, .doc. Not really knowing why that title, not really knowing whence the story came or where it was going, but sure that that was what it was called. Later, once the novel was finished, I thought, is this in fact the right title for the book? Because as you know, it carries with it a lot of baggage. So, Ghana Must Go. 1983, the Nigerian government summarily dismisses about 2 million immigrants to Nigeria, most of whom were Ghanaian, sending them back to Ghana with taunting slogans like Ghana Must Go or Ghana Go Home. And as they leave, these immigrants must pack up all of their things in the grand tradition of globalization, plastic bags, in fact, imported from China, made out of this red, white, and blue plastic plaid material that anyone who's been to an international airport has certainly seen. And so the Ghanaians leave, they return to Ghana, which at that time in 83 was itself going through the pains of a coup and of political unrest. And somehow, I love that this happens in history, a term that is applied to a population in a derogatory context is embraced by that population and used in, if not a celebratory one, then at least an evolved one. So now in Ghana, we call them Ghana Must Go bags or Ghana Go Home bags too. And Louis Vuitton has used the print. Celine just used the print in their latest show. And I love that. I love what it says about the Ghanaian spirit. I love what it says about the ability of human beings to take something that's tragic and make it triumphant. And in that sense, it is the perfect title for this novel.
Tell me about your own background, how you came here.
To D.C.?
To the United States.
To the United States,
yes.
Sure. I was born in London to a phenomenally beautiful, incredibly intelligent Nigerian Scottish mother and a Ghanaian surgeon father. My father went shortly thereafter to Saudi Arabia, where he still lives, and my mother brought my twin and me to the United States. And we were raised in a suburb of Boston called Brookline, which features prominently in the novel. And then about 15, just under 15 years ago, my mom moved back to West Africa, not to Nigeria where she's from, but to Ghana. And so now our family is sort of spread out between the States, the UK, the Middle East, and the outlier that would be myself living in Rome.
And your twin sister?
My twin sister is my best friend, and she's finishing her training in Baltimore, getting ready to go to the Hospital for Special Surgeries in New York.
Medicine was not in your mind?
It was shockingly no, given that my father is a surgeon, my mother a pediatrician, and my twin sister a physiatrist. But as I say, I put two and two together and get five. I'm absolutely innumerate. And though I tried my hardest to excel at math and science, nothing doing.
It didn't work.
It just didn't, Diane.
Were there expectations, though, that you and your twin sister would go along the same path?
To say the least. I think that I started saying around the age of 12 that I wanted to be a lawyer. It was an out-and-out lie, but it was the most relevant thing I could think to say that I would do with an age-old love of words and language and expression and argumentation even. But at that time in high school and even into college and grad school, I didn't have the courage to just simply say what I'd said at four, I want to be a writer. And so I was clinging sort of to this idea that I could, as a lot of, I think, creatively minded people do, that I could maybe make it in a law firm. That faded quickly. I took about two test LSATs and five or six logic games, and I thought, this is for the birds.
Not for me.
But I did go more hilariously still, on to Oxford to do a grad degree, thinking that perhaps I could get a PhD and then be a doctor, which didn't work either.
Gosh.
So I stopped with a master's in IR, an education for which I'm still grateful, and then finally got around to pursuing my childhood dream of becoming an author.
Why do you think you knew at such an early age that you wanted to be a writer?
Because I loved it so much. At four, I told my stepdad at the time that I loved words, and I meant it. And my mom, she's an incredible pediatrician. She taught us both to read when we were three, and it was my favorite pastime then. It's my favorite pastime now. As soon as I could clutch a little Crayola in my hand, I was writing very overwrought poetry even then. For Christmas this year, my mom gave me a framed poem. She'd found it. It was published in a newspaper in Brookline in 1989 when I was 9 years old.
Oh, my.
And I wrote, I was a little dramatic then. I'm still a little dramatic now. But I wrote at nine that I was a piece broken off of the written world. And when she showed me that this Christmas, we were in Ireland, I burst into tears because I thought to myself, you know, bloody hell, I felt this way in my entire life, that somehow something about the written world, the spoken word is me, is in me. And I guess I always knew that.
Taye Selassie, her first novel is titled Ghana Must Go. And we'll take a short break here. When we come back, she'll read for us and we'll take your calls. Welcome back. If you just joined us, Taye Selassie is with me. We're talking about her debut novel, which has been praised to high heaven, both in London, across the pond, here in the United States. It's titled Ghana Must Go. And it's important for you now to hear the opening. Will you read for us, please?
I shall. Chapter 1. Kwaku dies barefoot on a Sunday before sunrise, his slippers by the doorway to the bedroom like dogs. At the moment, he is on the threshold between sunroom and garden, considering whether to go back to get them. He won't. His second wife, Amma, is asleep in that bedroom, her lips parted loosely, her brow lightly furrowed, her cheek hotly seeking some cool patch of pillow, and he doesn't want to wake her. He couldn't if he tried. She sleeps like a cocoyam, a thing without senses. She sleeps like his mother, unplugged from the world. Their house could be robbed by Nigerians in flip-flops, rolling right up to their door in rusting Russian army tanks, eschewing subtlety entirely, as they've taken to doing on Victoria Island, or so he hears from his friends, the crude oil kings and cowboys, demobbed to Greater Lagos, that odd breed of African, fearless and rich. And she'd go on snoring sweetly, a kind of musical arrangement. dreaming sugar plums and Tchaikovsky, she sleeps like a child. But he's carried the thought anyway, from bedroom to sunroom, making a production of being careful, a show for himself. He does this, has always done this since leaving the village, little open-air performances for an audience of one or for two, him and his cameraman, that silent, invisible cameraman who stole away beside him all those decades ago in the darkness before daybreak with the ocean beside and who has followed him every day, everywhere since, quietly filming his life or the life of the man who he wishes to be and who he left to become. In this scene, a bedroom scene, the considerate husband, who doesn't make a peep as he slips from the bed, moving the covers aside noiselessly, setting each foot down separately, taking pains not to wake his unwakeable wife, not to get up too quickly, thus unsettling the mattress, crossing the room very quietly, closing the door without sound, and down the hall in this manner, through the door into the courtyard, where she clearly can't hear him, but still on his toes, across the short heated walkway from master wing to living wing, where he pauses for a moment to admire his house.
And then he dies.
He actually dies in the first two words of the book.
He really does. Tell us about this plot that you have created.
This plot came to me in all of its tangled glory. I think of Nabokov, look at this tangle of thorns. And I thought to myself, how on earth am I going to tell this story? But that first line, Kweku dies barefoot on a Sunday before sunrise,
came to you.
The whole thing, his slippers by the doorway to the bedroom like dogs, like something I was remembering. And I remember sitting there thinking, you can't start the book with the words Kweku dies. I mean, that's sort of giving the thing away, isn't it? But I, you know, like all of my first lines, it stuck. It insisted upon itself. And the rest of the story unfolded. And that story is simply one of a man and a woman, Kweku from Ghana, Fola from Nigeria, who meet in the States at a time when bright West Africans were given scholarships to come study in this part of the world. They fall in love. They have four children. They raise those children in Brookline, Massachusetts. And everything seems to be going along quite swimmingly until one evening when everything goes terribly awry. Kweku leaves the family, shockingly, without explanation.
He just leaves.
Poof.
He's gone.
He's gone. And the rest of the family is forced to come to grips not only with his departure and the painful events that it precipitates, but also their selves, their identities, their hurts, their losses, their longings, and indeed their love. And so by part three of the novel, in part one, Kweku dies as advertised. In part two, the family finds out, sort of Brookline snow chain style. one child calls, the other calls the next. And then in part three, the entire family goes to Ghana for Kweku's funeral, reuniting for the first time in years. So part one is gone, part two is going, and part three is go.
It was interesting to me that his wife waited for 10 weeks. Mm. I think she thought he might come back. Mm. She didn't know why he left.
No.
And we don't learn why he left until much later.
Right.
He's a successful surgeon.
That's right. That's right. It's interesting. I think that when I was writing this novel, I struggled a lot with the way Fola and Kweku come apart. I knew on some level, I still know, I think, that human beings can make decisions that are not decisions at all. It's almost the absence of a decision that calcifies into a choice. And I think when Kweku drives away, he does it in such a moment of deep disappointment, of fundamental existential despair.
In whom or what? In himself? In the marriage? In the children?
In the dream. In the dream. The dream that has carried him from the shores of Kukrubite, as he describes, at the edge of the world, the frayed edges, to this mansion in Brookline. This dream which has motivated him, inspired him, and I'm sure at times blinded him to his weaknesses as a human, his failings as a husband and a father. This dream in a moment falls apart. It crumbles and it dissolves. And in that moment, I believe he is without identity because he has put so much of himself into this dream. Of course, he isn't, but he doesn't know that. And so he leaves. And I think that Fola, meanwhile, you know, I joke, I think about 21st century movies and I laugh that storytellers have a much harder task in the age of cell phones than they ever did before. Because, of course, in the 90s, when this happens, Fola can't find Kwaku because he doesn't have a cell phone because there weren't cell phones. So the only way she would be able to reach him would be if he told her how to find him, and he doesn't. And so she can't. And in that moment, Fola is taken back to a previous identity of hers, which is when she lost her father. It's the beginning of a series of losses that Fola experiences. Losses that take place in the course of an evening, going from the spoiled daughter of a very wealthy father at breakfast to an orphan by nightfall.
And the question is, how much of your own life is built into the patterns of this novel?
Interesting. All of the surface details in Ghana Must Go were harvested shamelessly from the life that I've shared with my family. So my father's a surgeon, Kwaku's a surgeon. My mother's Nigerian and Scottish and loves flowers. Fola is Nigerian and Scottish and loves flowers. My twin went to Harvard Med. Olu goes to Harvard Med. My twin and I went to Yale, Sadie goes to Yale, and so forth. But the characterizations, the motivations, the psychology, the hurts, the shames, the loves, these belong to the characters. These were not taken from my life, and I believe that they arose to the extent that fiction does from the world of the novel, if that makes sense, informed though it is by the world that I know.
Did your mother and father separate and divorce?
Early and often. I once was trying to describe to a friend, I go to India every year and I stay with my ex-stepdad's ex-wife. That's exactly what she is.
Ex-stepdad's ex-wife.
And now one of my dearest friends, Nelly.
Oh, hell yeah.
Like my surrogate sister. And I was meeting a friend in India and he said, Who are you staying with again? And I said, oh, you know, my ex-stepdad's ex-wife and her now husband. And also my ex-stepdad's now wife sometimes comes too. And he said, oh, that's quite easy to understand. At a different point in time, we used to say we were related by marriage. And now we say we're related by divorce. So I've got a wonderful family by divorce. My family marries well, but divorce is even better. Anyway, so we know separation. We know loss. We know comings and goings in my family, for sure.
Is that part of what it means to be Afropolitan?
Interesting. Afropolitan, this identity, this experience, is something that I described in an essay that I wrote in 2005, trying to kind of get a handle myself on the question of, where are you from? So when I'm asked, where are you from? It always takes sort of 9 tries to get to a satisfying answer. It's like, I was born in England. Oh, but you don't really speak with a British accent. Okay, I grew up in Brooklyn. Oh, but you don't really speak with a Boston accent. And also, there's the issue of your melanin content. Okay, well, I'm from Ghana. And then I'm in Ghanaian. You're not really Ghanaian. Okay, well, my mom's Nigerian. Yeah, but you don't speak Yoruba. So I thought to myself, okay, basta. There has to be something that I am. And I am, because I say I am, Afropolitan. Meaning simply someone who is African. Let me say first and foremost that the two things are by no means mutually exclusive. And it always hurts my heart a little bit when I hear someone say, Afropolitans are people who are African but are sophisticated, and as if the things are mutually exclusive. I am African and I am Afropolitan and I have British and American passports. And I of course know comings and goings because that is a feature of the immigrant experience that gave rise to this identity in the first place.
What are the things, in addition to literature, that you love that create this Afropolitan designation, sensibility, creation?
Interesting. Well, for me, the thing that I love almost as much as literature, but not quite, the two things are photography and music. Huh. My work is hugely informed by my own study of music. I studied piano and cello, and I listen to music endlessly, and my passion for photography. So the visual and the auditory go so much into my experience of literature. So those are my loves. But in terms of the Afropolitan identity, I think we're speaking of global culture. And that's true for Africans, young Africans living in Africa and those living outside of it. We draw on an incredibly rich and diverse cultural tradition as Nigerians, Ghanaians, South Africans, Kenyans, hugely diverse one to the next. But we also participate in a global culture. And that's something that I think can sometimes go overlooked.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. The idea that somehow Americans may have of Africans very different from what you represent. Mm. You've had opportunity to be educated, to be recognized, to have your work acknowledged. Are there many, many others waiting for you to break through so that they can follow?
Indeed, there are many like me. There are more where I came from. And that's the exciting thing. It's true that representations of Africa, and I'm putting it in quotes because the way that that word gets used in this country always sort of makes me laugh, as if this entire continent, 54 countries deep, could be reduced, collapsed into a single cultural, political, economic, spiritual entity is sort of laughable, quite frankly. But yes, it's true that that monolith, which is already a misrepresentation, gets further misrepresented in a very monochromatic way. And the wonderful Nigerian novelist Chimamanda Adichie has it that we are in danger of telling a single story about a monolithic continent. And what I represent is nothing different than what you find in all 54 of those countries on the African continent. My family, rural and urban, values education above all else. And what I think that I am always reminded of when I look at my family living in Africa and in different countries around it is that, yes, it's true that large parts of the population on the African continent are poor. But we have to be careful not to conflate poverty and lack of intelligence. It's a dangerous thing that happens often in the context of the African continent and African countries. And if there's anything that I represent, I think it's the fierce commitment that my family has, that indeed every West African family I know has, to education. And what happens when you lower the barriers, simply the physical, socioeconomic barriers to receiving it.
What happens when, say, educated physicians from Ethiopia come here, or Ghana, come here, and I get into a taxi,
right,
and they tell me their background,
right?
And they are trained as physicians, they are trained as
academics,
university
economists,
professors, and they are driving taxis.
Yeah.
How does that make us, as Americans, associate Africans differently from what we would do if, say, an American, a white person, were out of a job and had to take to driving a taxi?
Right, right. I mean, not a taxi ride goes by in a day in New York City where I don't encounter one such. And, you know, it's interesting. I was in London. I was leaving London to go to the airport, and the taxi driver was from Ghana. This was an incredible case of life imitating art. It actually made me cry. And the taxi driver, his name was John. He was from Ghana. He was trained as a surgeon. He came to England, and he was fired from his job because of an accident in the operating room. And he told me this before I told him a word about my novel. I mean, my eyes were welling with tears as he was talking. And he said, I lost my job. But I did not lose my dignity. And I took this job driving taxis because I had to. And now I use the money that I've made driving this taxi to pay for Ghanaian students to come and study medicine in the UK. I think about my mom who went to med school in Lusaka in Zambia, and when she got to Boston had to go through her residency again.
All over again,
which of course means so much to me now, watching my sister go through her residency, imagining my sister doing what she's doing now, already having finished her training somewhere else. But I know what is true of my mom and what is true of that taxi driver, John, and what is true of a number of my taxi drivers and security guards and parking attendants and restaurateurs here in the United States. These are dignified people who are determined to give opportunity to others, even if it has been taken from them.
Taye Selassie, her first novel is titled Ghana Must Go. Your calls, your email, when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
Nobody expected Mike Piazza to make it in the big leagues, but he became a 12-time All-Star. On the next Fresh Air, Piazza talks about his life in the game, being inaccurately outed as gay, and getting a clubhouse call from Roger Clemens after the pitcher beamed him.
I was not in the mood to talk, so I basically told him where to put the phone.
Join us.
Before we go to the phones, I know, Taye, you want to complete a thought about dignity.
That's it, Diane. One reader, it was interesting. One reader said, without giving away too much of the plot, I'll say one reader said, I don't understand why Fola, the mother, would be willing to sell flowers outside of a hospital in Boston, but not beg for money or, in, you know, beg for financial aid. And I thought to myself, I understand that confusion because Nigerians and Ghanaians, let me speak for my own people. Nigerians and Ghanaians, we have so much pride and so much dignity in ourselves. There is a difference. There is a huge difference between driving a taxi, selling flowers, working in our minds and begging or relying on other people for help. This is something that I think it often gets lost in the American context, because when a West African person who has never thought of him or herself, has never conceived of him or herself as lacking, finds him or herself in a position of economic difficulty, there is a bit of cognitive dissonance there. Even when we West Africans find ourselves in middle class environments and, you know, the doors to scholarships are closed, our instinct is to work. And this is something that is so related to our sense of ourselves as dignified, even if poor.
All right. We have had a caller waiting from North Carolina. Carl, you're on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, Miss Diane, how you doing?
I'm good, thanks.
You got the greatest show on earth.
Thank you.
I was going to ask the lady, did she ever get discouraged when she first got rejected? And also, as an African, like the ladies like Miss Diane, the elite, the most powerful people in the world, they used to really tell black folk, listen, you're the oldest civilization. You before the Arabs were there, you were all over the world. King Tut's tomb is the greatest finding on earth. Rosetta Stone come from Africa. You always was in language. So why didn't black folk brag on their own culture? They said, I mean, white folk like Mr. Ann said, way before Arabs or home was even existed, black folks was all over the world. So why black folk don't brag on black folk?
Mm-hmm. It's Carl, hi. It's a wonderful, wonderful point you make. To your first question, did I get discouraged mm-hmm. with the rejections? I cried so many tears. I have the best waterproof eyeliner you will ever know because of the tears that I cried. I mean, it was so discouraging. But you have to somehow believe in your own work. You have to believe in your own voice. And I remember when Sex Lives was rejected, I thought, okay, this reader does not like the second person, does not like my sort of dense lyrical writing, but do I? And I really had to confront that question. And I realized that if I was okay with it, then it was okay with me. To your second point, my aunt Renee, she runs an institute in Ghana called the Kokrobete Institute. She always says that West Africa must be thought of as an old world to the Americas, no less than Europe. And she has done a wonderful job of helping me understand the extent to which specifically West African, but East African also, culture, wisdom, understanding has informed the culture, the experience, the humanity in this part of the world, but it doesn't get discussed. I think what you're pointing to is a lack of education. And I think if we knew more about the ways in which African cultures have informed cultures here, we would celebrate it.
Here's a wonderful email saying, you are telling my life story.
Oh.
I have Cameroonian parents, was born in London. Both parents were in the medical profession.
Mm-hmm.
We went back to Cameroon. When we returned to England, our father never joined us and stayed estranged for decades. When he tried to muscle back in, our family collapsed in a heat of deceit and disappointment. I moved to the States 20 years ago and finally found the depth of my African heritage that has brought me full circle to where I am today. I, too, am an Afropolitan with a Jamaican-American husband.
Oh.
The world is incredible.
It is.
Isn't that wonderful?
It's beautiful. Thank you so much for that email.
Let's go to Macomb, Michigan. Good morning, Alicia.
Good morning. I am so giddy and filled with joy right now.
I'm so glad.
Me too, Alicia.
I have more of a comment than a question. Diane, thank you so much for lighting a political fire in my life.
Oh, I'm so glad.
An absolute inspiration. And I often go out and purchase books after I hear them talked about on NPR, but this is probably the quickest. Through the course of just listening to your prose, you have such a beautiful tone and your message just seems like a true inspiration for the entirety of the human race. So thank you,
Alicia,
for your show today.
And thank you for letting us know what it means to you. Here's an email from Gabriella, who's in Dallas, Texas. First, she says, your guest has a delicious laugh. And then she says, I just tuned in and will pay attention to the interview, but I just had to make that comment. hit me, it seems to speak of her sincerity and her open heart. How refreshing.
Oh, hook 'em horns.
All right, and let's go to Barry, who in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning.
Good morning, Diana. Thank you. I always listen to you very often.
Thank you.
I'm addicted with it. I love it. But I just, it's a simple question. Miss Solomon, hi, Selassie. I'm Ethiopian American. The name sounds like an Ethiopian name, our ex-king name, Haile Selassie. Is that how you sound it, or I misheard it?
It's a common mistake. So the name Selassie is a very common Ewe name. From the Ewe, we find the Ewe in Ghana and in Togo and in other parts of West Africa, because the Ewe people, as you would know, lived sort of in a horizontal band before those countries were chopped up. But my father is Ewe, and he gave me the name Selassie, which means in Ewe, God has heard or answered prayer. But I'm happy to say that there is an incredible linguistic connection between the Ewe language and the Amharic that you find in Ethiopia, and even the Hebrew. And that is something that I intend to study next. I'm so fascinated by the fact that we find in Ghana, in our Ewe language, words that you have in yours.
Isn't that interesting? And words connect us all around the world.
They sure do.
Taye, read for us again, if you would.
And I will. I'm going to read from the middle of the book. This is in the voice of Taiwo, whose name you may notice sounds shockingly like mine, because our names mean first twin in Yoruba. There was the sense in her house of an ongoing effort, of an upswing mid-motion, a thing being built, a successful family with the six of them involved in the effort, all striving for the common goal, as yet unreached. They were unfinished, in rehearsal, a production in progress, each performing his role with an affected aplomb and with the stress of performance ever present for all as a soft sort of sound in the background, a hum. There was him straining daily to perform the provider, and Fola's star turn as suburban housewife, and Olu's as fastidious, come favored first son, the artist, gifted, awkward, and the baby, then she, determined to deliver a flawless performance, to fly from the stage, chased by thunderous applause, darling daughter of champions, elementary school standout, the brightest of pupils in bright-eyed class pictures. No one asked her to do this. Not him, never Fola. No one mapped their joint progress toward the one goal. Were they there yet? Had they made it? Had they become a successful family? But she knew to keep going, to keep striving by the hum. The families in the windows were successful families already, had finished the heavy lifting generations ago, were not building or straining or making an effort. The goal had been reached. They could rest now, calm down. At night, through their windows, she saw them there, finished, with silence between them in place of the hum, placid familiness captured in paint above mantles, with feet up on cushions, at rest and at home.
There is the sound of poetry in your work, and one wonders whether you are reading aloud to yourself as you write.
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I do not read aloud to myself as I write, because the words come so quickly.
Really?
They do, Diane. When I, wow. they come or they don't. So there are times when there is a drought, and then there are other times when it's deluge. And when that happens, I go to the computer, and my father always says I type like a maniac. Just it's clack, 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 clack. My hands just go until they stop. And then what I have to do is I have to print out the words on two sides, of course, out of respect for the environment. And then I read them out loud. And I think that's because as I say, the music of the language is so important to me. I studied Latin forever, and we were always studying meter, and I listened to music incessantly, and the phrases, the bars, the repetition, the motif, all of this is as important to me as the language itself. As my editor said 2 days ago, for me, words are not enough. There's something, there's meaning, there is truth in sound and in something that exists beyond the world of the novel and the words themselves. And that is something that I only know how to access in the flow.
How is fame affecting you?
Not at all. The best thing about having a twin sister is that you will always, always stay humble.
Now, tell me what that means, because I know you have said you can be on separate coasts.
Absolutely.
And feel what the other is feeling.
It's unreal. I was in England about to do an interview, and it was 8 in the morning in England, and so dead of the night in Baltimore. And I woke up in perfect calm, was getting ready, putting on my waterproof eyeliner, when all of a sudden I was in a panic. And I was sitting there and I thought, there's nothing wrong with me, so this panic must be my sister's. And this happens sometimes, it's just misplaced. And I thought to myself, okay, I should call her. But then I thought, no, it's so early and she's a resident, she doesn't get to sleep, I'll write to her. So I wrote to her on WhatsApp. I just wrote, Yetza, are you okay? Thinking that she would see it when she woke up. She wrote back right away. I just woke up from a nightmare in which I was being chased and I was in a panic. And I just wrote to her. And it's not even really surprising at this point. It's just sort of like, oh, okay, would you like to take your panic back? Because I've got to do an interview.
Wow.
And then the interviewer asked me, can you tell me about your connection to your sister? I just showed her the dialogue.
You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Clifford in Reston, Virginia. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, Diane. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thank you, sir.
I love your show. I love your show.
Thank you.
I love your show so much. I listen to your show every day.
I'm so glad.
Sometimes I've been trying to reach you on phone. I can't reach you because of thousands of people who are about to call
Clifford,
you. Too.
Clifford, you sound like you're from my part of the world.
From where?
From my part of the world.
No, I'm from Nigeria, a typical Nigerian man.
And my mother is from Nigeria.
Yeah.
So
I'm from Nigeria.
Okay, so what would you like to say to Taye?
Where from Nigeria are you from?
Oh, we're Yoruba.
Oh, Yoruba, okay. Yeah. Oh!
Fantastic.
I really thank you for your courage. I really thank you. Though I didn't listen from the beginning of the program, but from where I started hearing it, you have been so wonderful. So wonderful.
Eshe.
And I really, really, really encourage you. Show and started to express and to tell the world what you are. I really, 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 really support your courage.
Eshe, Clifford. Eshe.
Thank you so much for calling. And one last quick call from McKinney, Texas. Good morning, Ricky.
Hey, good morning, Diane. Thank you for having me on your show, and thank you for still providing authentic journalism in a day and age where we don't get it anymore.
Thank you.
And also, it might have more of a comment. I just wanted to thank the author for finally telling the African story of hard work and diligence and never giving up, because I myself am from Zimbabwe, and I came to the United States and had so many doors shut, but I had to work through different fast food jobs and any job I could get until I my degree and paid my way through everything. So it was painful, and I appreciate you putting this story forth and letting everybody know.
It's my honor and my pleasure. Thank you.
One thing we want to say here is you write about childbirth, and many of your characters experience death. How does that relate to you?
It's interesting. I know as little of childbirth as I know of death. I'm not a mother, and I've been blessed in my life not to have lost terribly many people. But I think when any novelist writes, but certainly a young one, you have to open yourself. You have to open your receptors, if you will, to truths that are beyond you. You have to let those flow through you. You have to allow yourself to be a conduit for them. And Ghana Must Go is full of things that I know to be true, but I don't know from my own experience to be so. And I love it that way.
Taye Selassie, her new novel, her first, is titled Ghana Must Go. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Susan Neighbors, Rebecca Kaufman, and Lisa Dunn. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yorv-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations.